Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Steve Ballmer.
Well, thanks. I am pumped up to have a chance to be here today. I may not do the developer prance, since I don't think I could ever do it as well as I did it many, many lean years ago. But it is great to be here at what is actually the biggest PDC we've ever done. We changed our format this year. We decided, hey, look, in recognition of the fact that most of the people who want to get at the key information and what's going on from a developer standpoint at Microsoft, we said, hey, look, how do we really orient this as much to people who can't travel as to the people who can? And so we have over 30,000 people joining us in events around the world, live. We'll have many, many more be able to watch. We put the same infrastructure behind this event, in fact, that we did behind the streaming of both the Olympics and March Madness this year, so that everything we do at this PDC can be captured, recorded, broadcast, not to just 1,000 people here and the 30,000 people who are at events live, but also to many, many others, colleagues, people that you and others need to touch with the materials that we'll cover over the course of this PDC 2010. So to everybody who either watches delayed, is watching live in events, and certainly to the folks who took their precious time and came and traveled to spend with us here in Seattle, it is really an honor and privilege to have a chance to welcome you, share some things we're pretty enthusiastic about. We're going to have a lot of focus this year. We think we've got some exciting things to talk to you about. With Internet Explorer and where it is, with Windows Phone, with Windows Azure. But I'm going to start by trying to give you a little broader context and then focus in some. As the people who are here live saw, I dropped my clicker, so I'm going to bend down and pick it up. That probably didn't work too well for webcast, but anyway. Let me start with the sense I have of how much incredible innovation our industry and our company is driving, and what I think that means to all of us as developers. It's almost unbelievable, in a sense, that despite the fact the computer revolution is 50 years old, the personal computer revolution is about 30, 35 years old, we're sitting here today, and the ability to do wild, impressive, amazing things with software technology is greater today than at any time in history. The move to more smart devices, little screens, big screens, medium screens, call them PC, phone, TV, slate, blah, 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 but smart devices of all kinds. The cloud is a backplane on which to program and rapidly deploy applications. These are powerful new platforms that are creating a wave of new opportunity to do another set of exciting applications with user interfaces that are more and more approachable than ever before. And certainly we're driving hard. We're driving hard on the redefinition of the device types, the PC. You'll see a range of exciting things that people are doing with Windows as we move forward. The phone. Couldn't be more excited to have Windows Phone 7 now in the market in a number of countries and coming to the United States here very soon. Xbox. For those of you who haven't seen yet, take a look at this new Xbox Kinect. It is really remarkable how we can change the way in which people get a chance to interact naturally with systems, with voice, with gesture, with camera recognition. It's remarkable. You know, we're driving on a broad set of fronts, the devices, and then on the back end, the Azure platform, Windows and SQL Azure, the experiences, Office 365, including SharePoint as a core building block and platform, Bing, which increasingly we're taking a look at the ways to open up and make more of a platform on which developers can create applications that program, if you will, against the data that's out on the internet. Windows Live and Xbox Live as fundamental services that support the devices. The glue that I think allows this world to come together and allows for amazing innovation is HTML5. HTML5 becomes, in some senses, it's not all the code that'll get written, but it's a way of allowing and facilitating a level of independence and innovation between the back end and the front end, even as people continue to invest in new front end user interface and ways to write applications to smart devices that build on and go beyond what might be in HTML5, and people build applications on the back end that increasingly think about that as their lingua franca for talking to all of these smart devices across the planet. At Microsoft, this kind of all starts with Windows. Windows PCs are our most popular smart device. In just the last 12 months, the world has bought approximately 350 million new personal computers. And we've sold 240 million new Windows 7 licenses in just the last year. 240 million. Phones are going to be very important. TVs are going to be very important. The PC is the number one smart device on the planet today. And there's lots of innovation going on. You'll see a range of new form factors for this holiday season, after this holiday season, and throughout next year in the Windows personal computer, if you will. Netbooks, tablets, you'll see people push. They'll build on the ink and touch support, which is built into every copy of Windows 7. And with new devices, you as developers will say, hey, look, I now see the device that makes it make sense to me to really have my application exploit the inking and touch capabilities that are built into Windows 7. The momentum of Windows 7 with developers is unparalleled. There's a lot of things out there that people are targeting, and yet every website and every application, the first thing you say is, how do I get this thing to really render well, to make sense, to look good? Whether I take advantage of unique capabilities in Windows or I'm simply writing a website talking HTML5, how do I make sure that my work looks beautiful and matters on a Windows PC? With the work that we're doing with Internet Explorer, we're trying to make that a whole lot simpler for you. With Internet Explorer 9, we made our focus on a couple of things. Number one, doing HTML5, standards-based HTML5 really, really, really well. And number two, asking the question, how do we improve on the user experience for HTML5 applications based upon the fact that we know Internet Explorer runs on Windows? How do we integrate, if you will, applications and websites from a user experience perspective? How do we take advantage of the power of Windows and the Windows PC to improve the performance of HTML5-based applications? We've tried to make the web feel more like native applications. We've worked hard on interoperability so that you can apply more of your energy on innovation and less just on rewriting sites. We committed to the W3C and the standards process. We've been helping to co-chair the HTML5 working group. There's 70-plus participants in over 40-plus different groups that we've applied to trying to really help drive the standards forward. And we think the modern web, in some senses, gets a chance to really take off with HTML5, and that's why with Internet Explorer 9, we've put so much energy into really making HTML5 look great and perform great, unlocking the full power of the PC and the full power of the web, kind of in one seamless exercise, if you will. Great graphics, great interactivity, and consistent markup across sites. I'm pleased to report to you that after 6 weeks, we launched Internet Explorer 9 about 6 weeks ago. We got very good reviews. We launched with over 70 partners that have some of the most popular websites on the planet. But we've already passed now, in just 6 weeks, 10 million downloads on Internet Explorer 9, making it the most downloaded beta release of Internet Explorer, certainly ever. And we're very pleased with the acceptance we've seen, not only from end users and reviewers who've loved the features, but developers who are saying, hey, not only do I like IE9 and the way it embraces standards, but I see ways for me to enhance my website in terms of the way it renders itself on IE9, on the PC, and really kind of comes and fits together. I'm going to have Dean Hakamovich, who runs the Internet Explorer team, come on stage, remind you a little bit about IE9, and then have a chance to show you some of the cool things that developers are doing to build upon HTML5 standards and the way we allow you to take that into the Windows environment. So please welcome Dean Hakamovich.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks. Thanks, Steve. It is exciting to be here at the PDC to show IE9. In the 6 weeks since we released the beta of Internet Explorer 9, we've seen 10 million downloads and a lot of enthusiasm from developers. Today, we're going to talk about three things. First, the developer opportunity of HTML5, of hardware-accelerated HTML5 on Windows. We're going to talk about the developer opportunity for your site to feel more like an application on Windows 7. And we're going to talk about how that developer opportunity gets better today. Let's take a look at the product. So here is IE9. And what you see is a browser that puts the site at the center of the user's focus and the user's experience. IE9 as a browser says, look at the site, not look at me. Now, the site is from KEXP. KEXP is a Seattle radio station. It's independent, it's local, and all the DJs have their own style. I think you heard DJ Riz earlier this morning. And the DJs get to pick their own music. And we worked with them on 10 years of playlist data to find a great way to visualize that in HTML5, and that's the site that you see here. So let's take a look at this. Now, this is all HTML5. And you see that these are interactive. This is using the canvas tag. What you're actually looking here is albums and playlist data. So I can go through and choose a particular album, maybe this one, and I can click on it, and I'll get information. How many times each song was played, I can scroll through, I can go to websites, because it's the browser and it's HTML. I can go through and look at what DJs have done. So here's DJ Riz, and these are the top 5 albums played by DJ Riz during these dates. And again, it's a website. I can click in, I can see what DJ Riz played the most, I can check out these others as well. Now, again, this site is a great example of how full hardware acceleration makes a difference for the experiences that you build. It's very rich. I mean, it's HTML5, right? There's great typography. There's a custom font that's downloaded using the WAF standard. There's animation. And it's a big canvas, not just one little canvas in the middle of the screen. It's an enormous canvas. In fact, it doesn't feel like a web page. And that's why it's important to use the whole PC and graphics hardware to accelerate the page. Now, this is nice. Why don't we ratchet it up a little bit? I'll close this. And let's see what else we can do here. Well, first, I'm going to add some video. So This is a full HD video using the HTML5 video tag playing in the background. And you'll see that the frames per second really hasn't budged because we're using the whole PC. Now, I can still interact with the page. Here I'm clicking and dragging on these elements, and you can see that they're lighting up and following my mouse. I can still interact with all the albums, and that's great. Let's make this a little bit more taxing. Why don't we add some alpha blending to the albums? Why don't we have them scale up and down and even rotate? Now, here's the point. HTML5 enables you to make engaging and interactive sites. With full hardware acceleration of the browser, HTML5 pages feel and run like an app or a game. Now, why don't we take a look at another example? And this one also illustrates the impact of full hardware acceleration. It's called Track Splash. It's a little less sophisticated visually, but why don't we take a look at it? I'll go ahead and I'll start the race. And what you hear is HTML5 audio, also hardware accelerated. I have to talk over the motorboat. It's really exciting. Now, the reason this surface back here looks so realistic is that it's a video. It's HTML5 video of water. Helps the realism. If you look in the background, perfect timing. The buoy is canvas, the beach, the trees, the sky, that's all canvas. And you see that it's running at 60 frames a second, even with the opacity and the alpha blending that's going on in the background. Now, it can run at 60 frames a second, even though, again, it's HTML. I can do view source on this, and it's web standard markup. And it can run at 60 frames a second because of the hardware acceleration. Now, I'm going to put that away, and we'll try this in another browser. That load up. And this is the latest stable Chrome beta. And the first thing you'll see is that it runs. Let me refresh here. The first thing you'll notice is that it runs. And that's because it's web standard markup. It's HTML5. The HTML5 video plays. You'll see the performance differences are a little bit different. It's now at around 40 frames a second. The video's been a little bit jerky. But that difference is huge in using the full power of the PC. IE accelerates the whole web. Video, audio, text, SVG, canvas, and all the other graphics on your page. Accelerating only pieces of the browser holds back developers and your sites. Now, let's look at the opportunity that sites have to feel more like an app on Windows 7. All right, so if you look down across the bottom of the screen here, you'll see that on the Windows 7 taskbar, I've got a bunch of websites. There's Bing, that's wallstreetjournal.com, not a separate application, but the actual website that I've pinned, that any user can pin, down at the taskbar. Now, developers can program jump lists. Here you see the Bing developers decided what items should be here and how they should look. You see the iconography matches the Bing site. Here's what Twitter chose to put. You can see that that's completely up to them, and the look and feel is theirs. Here's what Hotmail has chosen. Now, they've looked across Windows Live and said, here's what we want on the jump list to make available to all of our users. Let's take a look at how a user does this. So I'll bring up IE, and I'll navigate over to Amazon.com. And here I am at Amazon. And I can just take the tab and drag it down to the taskbar. When I drag it, I've pinned the site. Now, it's great. I have the Amazon logo. The fave icon is nice and big and down on the taskbar. Windows automatically provides a nice thumbnail preview. You see the Amazon icon is in the browser frame as well. And you see that the back and forward buttons have picked up the color of the website. And you can actually, as a developer, program that color specifically if you want to. Now, I'll put that away. And you know, let's see what it takes to do all this. So I'll bring up a site that I've been working on. It's HTML5 Radio. It's a bunch of songs about HTML5. See, Div and Conquer? Get it? OK. We'll try that later, really. OK, so here's my site. And I'm going to drag it down. And I'm going to pin it as well. And you'll see that the fave icon shows up down in the taskbar. And the back and forward buttons look great. And I get a thumbnail preview. And when I right-click, there is a jump list, but there's nothing to it. So that's what you get for free. Before you do anything specific for IE9 in Windows 7, users can pin your site and have that. Now, let me unpin this and close this, and let's see what work is involved in really taking advantage of Windows 7. So here I am in a dev environment, and I'm going to just drag this code in. Let's take a look at what it does. Well, the first part is a bunch of meta tags that you've all used on web pages, and it programs the static jump list. The next is just some JavaScript that puts puts buttons on the thumbnail preview. So I can program functions on the thumbnail preview when users go to it. Then there's a dynamic jump list. So depending on what song you've just listened to, the jump list will change and offer you different options. And finally, there's some notifications. And these notifications are great because as people are doing stuff on the site and there's information and stuff changes, the user can then find out about it. So I'm going to save this code change, and I'll put that away. I'll go back to my HTML radio site now. And I'll pin it again. And it's down there. In fact, now, even when I minimize the site, I can come over, and I have a thumbnail preview, and I can just hit play. And that's a great song about HTML5. I can hit pause, which is very important right now. I can skip ahead. I can say that I really like the song. I can right-click and get a jump list. There's that static jump list that we programmed, and here's the dynamic one that's based on the song I last listened to, consistent line endings. And you'll see that I have this notification that came up. Some people got that. On the way home, you'll figure it out, right? And you see this number came up because I have three friend notifications coming into me because all over the interwebs, people are communicating. So, you know, that's great. This code is straightforward to write. It's very easy to reuse, and it benefits you and your users in huge ways. Your website participates with Windows applications on the desktop. They are more available. They are more interactive than regular sites in old browsers. And the sample code for this and much more is available at www.ietestdrive.com. Now, we looked at the dev opportunity of HTML5, hardware-accelerated HTML5 on Windows. We looked at how to make your sites feel more like apps. Now, let's talk about how the opportunity gets even better today. Today, we're updating the IE9 platform for developers. IE9 Platform Preview 6 is available now for download at ietestdrive.com. The new platform preview build brings better performance, brings better quality, and it brings increased standard support. For example, IE9 now supports CSS3 2D transforms, which is very cool. It also supports HTML5 semantic tags. And why don't we take a look at it right now? So I'll come over here. And here's the platform preview. You can see that it is the thinnest possible wrapper around the web browsing platform. And it's meant for developers. It's got the F12 dev tools so that you can check out the code and debug your sites. It doesn't have an address bar or back button because it's really for your code and for samples like this. It's not a general browser. So here's the sample. And what you'll see is that it's a very rich experience put on top of Flickr. And as I hover over any of these images, you'll see that they rotate and zoom in. Now, this is using web standard markup, CSS3 2D transforms. And in fact, you'll notice that the text on both sides is rotated as well. Now, these are custom fonts that are actually not installed on the machine. They're downloaded through the WAF standard in order to make your website look exactly the way that you want it to look. Now, you can do queries. In fact, there are a lot of fun things I can do. I can put more text up here because it'll just query more information. I can have a messy layout, and that'll do even more CSS3 2D transforms. And you see, it's just great. It's very fast. It's a high-quality implementation. You can see all the text rotates as well. And again, this uses web standards. So the same markup, the same HTML, the same CSS, the same script will run in other browsers. Now, you can try this. And other samples at ietestdrive.com. Please download the beta if you haven't already. Try the new platform preview build. Start taking advantage of HTML5 and full hardware acceleration on Windows. Make your site feel more like an application when users pin it on Windows 7. There's lots of dev excitement around HTML5. Thanks for trying it out on IE9 and on the platform preview builds. Thank you.
Can you take the clicker? In case that wasn't clear, ietestdrive.com. I want to turn now and talk a little bit about Windows Phone and have a chance to show you and kind of give you a little update on where some of that work is. We launched Windows Phone 7 about 2 weeks ago. The phones are on sale in a number of countries, coming to the United States here over the course of the next few weeks. And we tried to do a number of things with Windows Phone, particularly given that we're entering a market in which there's already a lot of activity. I think we really kind of nailed it. Windows Phone is a different kind of phone. It looks different. It works different. It has all of the diversity of hardware selection that people would hope for, because people really have very individual tastes in phones. And yet it has all of the coherence from the user experience standpoint, and particularly from the developer experience standpoint, that make it possible for it to be a broad ecosystem that is really coherent for your work, from a user interface standpoint, as well as from a user presentation standpoint. We put a different kind of design point. We said, hey, instead of putting the application as the only center point, yes, there are a lot of applications people are going to want, but how do we take the things that the users care about and love and make them the center point of the experience? The people I care about, the places I care about, the music and entertainment I care about. And then how do we give a framework into which you as developers can paint in and add into the user's world, as opposed to just have a chance to write applications? And we think we've done some very good things in that regard. Windows Phone 7, certainly from a user interface standpoint, is thoroughly modern. I mean, you take a look at a Windows Phone 7 and you just say, woo. I mean, I happen to be carrying one of about five that I've been carrying regularly today. And any time I just have it out, show it to somebody, and you'll all get a Windows Phone 7 today. That'd be part of what we talk about. But when you see that phone, you get... But the consistency with which we delight people, I think, is amazing. That was probably the easiest form of delight on the planet. You know, the whole goal here is to get people in and out of their phone and back to whatever they're really trying to do, and to have that happen pretty quickly. We have hardware from LG, from Samsung, from HTC, from Dell. We have phones that'll be available from over 60 different operators in 30 different countries. You'll have bigger and smaller screens, devices with keyboards and without, devices that are a little bit more rugged for the kind of pounding certainly some users deliver to these phones, and devices that are more refined and gentle and elegant for some of the other constituents who are going to want to come into the world. I thought maybe we'd show you, we just debuted the ad campaign for Windows Phone 7. I thought we'd just show you just a little bit of a clip, because it tells you a little bit how we're going to communicate and why we think then we'll drive a lot of users for your applications. Roll the video, please.
Really?
Really?
It's time for a phone to save us from our phones. New Windows Phone, designed to get you in and out and back to life.
And man, are we going to pump and thump. You'll see a lot of those ads over the course of the next several months. We think we've got great product with a great story to tell. And one of the keys now for us is really to get all of your great work, to get the applications built and into the marketplace, and to talk to you a little bit about that, to show you some of the applications that folks like you and others around the world have already written. And to show you how easy it is to build application, please welcome up on stage Scott Guthrie. Scott runs our development platform group.
Sure. Well, thanks, Steve. Windows Phone 7 delivers a great developer platform that enables you to build amazing applications and games. And better yet, it includes an integrated marketplace so that anyone that has a phone can easily browse, download, and buy any of the experiences that you deliver. We launched Windows Phone 7 about a week ago, and in that time, we've already had over 1,000 application and games uploaded into the marketplace. And what I'd like to do is to kick things off before we get into the details is actually invite Brandon Watson on stage, who's actually going to show us a sampling of just a few of them that are out there today. So please welcome Brandon.
Hey. It's a funny thing. I never get phone calls, and I've gotten two in the last 30 seconds, so we'll see how this goes. I got my live phone. So hey, thanks for having me here, Scott. I'm going to show a couple things today. I want to start off with an Xbox Live title from PopCap. This is Bejeweled. It's a funny thing about this game. I was talking to Andrew Stein over at PopCap, the guys who make the game, and he said that despite the fact that they had no previous C# experience and very limited experience with the phone and the dev tools, they actually think that this is one of the best iterations of Bejeweled that they've ever had. And so as you see, it's a pretty frenetic game, and it's actually a lot harder to demo this on stage in front of all these people, but lots of animation, good particle effects. I mean, it's a really engaging gameplay. You've got the Xbox Live integration for achievements. Trust me, I put about 16 hours into this game since last week trying to get one. But it's just a great, very engaging gameplay. And so what I'm going to do here is actually pop out of the game and go back to the Xbox Live hub, because again, it's not just about the games. There's a consumer experience here as well, and as a game developer, you can integrate with the hub. This is where customers will have access to the games, some Spotlight where we can do some merchandising, and of course, I can pull my phone out. That's my actual Xbox Live avatar, and Loose Cannon 74. It's my gamer tag, Loose Cannon. Surprise, surprise. And my achievements. So I can pull my phone out and share that with my friends. It's very, very cool, nice integrated experience with Xbox Live. This is the LG Quantum phone. I want to actually show you, this is my personal phone. This is always a bit risky. This is the Facebook app running on AT&T Samsung Focus. This will be available on November 8th. And this is the Facebook app. These guys wanted to build a great first-party application that really showcased the distinctive user interface of Windows Phone 7 and their app as well. So I have all the things I would expect to see, my news feed and photos. And as you see, it's very smooth UI. I have access to photos, very pretty, very visually arresting application. And as I move through this panorama, I'm going to actually come back and go in and look at my profile. It's got the greasy fingers. Sweating a little bit. So I can go and actually take a look at my wall, or I can do an update. So I'm actually going to go ahead and trying not to screw up. And there you go. Hey, look at that. Worked. I'm so excited. Didn't type right? Good. So we get the update to Facebook status. Hey, that's pretty cool. But they also take advantage of the pivot control. Look at those very smooth animations, right? You get that for free with the pivot control as part of the Windows Phone developer tools. And so here they make all of the things that you'd expect for Facebook available, including my photos. Now, the photos is interesting because as I jump back out here to the live, the start screen, you've got these live tiles. You can see I've got the two phone calls, a couple text messages. It's about the glanceability of the data. I can look at my phone, have a sense of what I need to do, and back out. But the Photos Hub here is, as a developer, you can actually integrate with the hubs. And so I don't have to think about, was I using the Photo Bucket app or the Facebook app? I just want to show photos to my friends. It's about understanding what the consumers want to do. And so here I've got a picture. It's pulling from my library. These are my three kids. It makes the phone more personal to me. But I'm actually going to just jump in here and again show you that all of these photos, I've got my camera roll, my library, but I've got photos here from Facebook, I've got photos from SkyDrive, I've got photos from Windows Live, so it's all of my photos being located in my hub that we can take advantage of with these integrated experiences and really smart design. And so, again, these photos live up at Facebook, it's pulling down the data, and you can see that I can go ahead and leave comments, the whole thing that you'd expect with Facebook, but it's integrated into the Photo Hub. And this is actually a photo of me at the Orange Store on Oxford Street last week when phones went on sale, holding up a newspaper. Makes me think about reading on a mobile device. When I read on my mobile devices, I have an Amazon Kindle. I love it. I actually bought one of the new ones for my wife last week. The guys at Amazon, actually, they're going to let me share a little secret with you. We have the very first look of the Amazon Kindle app on Windows Phone 7. Yeah. Well, save the applause for how beautiful this app is, right? I mean, if you take a look at it, it makes me want to read. Again, they take advantage of the distinctive user interface and styling of Windows Phone 7 to build this really good-looking app But it also has the very familiar user interface elements of the panorama, swipe. Right? I know how to use the app, despite the fact that it is very clearly an Amazon Kindle app. This is a unique to Windows Phone 7 feature, the Kindle Store. They make recommendations. I have three kids, no surprise, it's kid books. But I'm going to go back here, show you the reading experience. This is Tony Hsieh's book about his experiences at Zappos, Delivering Happiness. So, you know, bring up the text very fast, very fluid. Look at how crisp that looks, but maybe, you know, you've got bad eyes or you guys in the audience want to see the text a little better, so I can go in and just make it bigger. It's just that fast. But Amazon being Amazon, you know, they want people to read the books. So, Scott, I'm going to go ahead. They've got this nice feature where I can share a link. And I know you want to be delivering happiness to your developers. You guys have built a great set of tools in the app plat here. So, Scott, here we go. Scott Goo at Microsoft. It preloads the email. Off it goes. And hopefully you buy a box of these for your dev team because they've done such a great job. So that's the Amazon Kindle app on Windows Phone 7. And now I'm going to jump out. I already showed the one game, Bejeweled. I'm going to show you guys an app for another game. It's called How Much Do I Owe the Government? Intuit, it's built a really great, this is their first Windows Phone 7 app. It's a companion app, a brand builder on top of TurboTax, the industry-leading tax software. And as you can see, it's a way for me to enter my personal information and to give me a sense of how I should be planning for my taxes for the year. I owe a little bit of money. I've preloaded some information here, but I actually forgot a couple deductions. I've got those kids, and it turns out the government wants me to have kids, which is nice. They're going to give me some money back. So, you know, again, you've got the pivot control, very smooth, very clean animations. I'm going to jump in here and just add the family tab and go ahead and add one child here on the slider control. And what this is actually doing is it's going up to the cloud, hitting their tax tables, doing some calculations, and coming back down to the phone to accurately reflect how much I'm going to owe or get back. But it's a good thing I have three kids because I think I actually am going to get a little bit more money back. And hopefully this might be a good way to start the morning. I find out, hey, I'm actually getting money back. So that's feeling pretty good about that. So look, those are a few apps on Windows Phone 7. Again, you've got the smart design and the integrated experiences. And very beautiful apps, very consistent user interface. Hope I've inspired you guys to go download the tools and show us what you can create and build great things. Thanks, Scott.
Thanks, Brandon. Well, great tools make it easier to build great applications. And with Visual Studio and Expression Blend, we think we have the best tools out there now for doing phone development. And best of all, they're available for free. So you can go ahead, download the tools, install them, build your first app within minutes, and all the experiences that you saw Brandon just demo, you can build yourself and upload into the marketplace. And what I thought I'd do is actually, though, just talk about how they're great. Instead of just talking about how they're great, is actually show building an app from scratch. And so let's actually switch over here and write some code. And what I'm going to do here is use Visual Studio Express for Windows Phone. This is the free version of Visual Studio that you can download. And I'm just going to go ahead here and build a new project. And so I'm going to say file new project within it. And you'll notice I have two templates. I can actually use some XNA templates if I want to build a game. And I can use the Silverlight templates if I want to build an app. And you'll notice that we actually have a bunch of pre-populated templates that you can start off with. So if you want to start with a completely blank application, you can. Alternatively, if you want, you can start with something like, say, the Panorama application, which will give you that nice metro look and feel. So we'll just say PDC demo today. Hit OK, and this is going to go ahead and create a new application for us. You'll notice we have a nice design view surface that we can use. I've got a source view XAML experience here and my standard project explorer and so forth. Now, before we write any code, let's actually just run and see kind of what we just got by default. Now, I can use, if you have a device, which Steve hinted you might have one soon, you can actually go ahead and change from the dropdown. Alternatively, we also provide a built-in emulator. And what the emulator does is it basically runs the Windows Phone operating system and gives you the ability to actually build your apps without even having to have a device. And so what you're seeing here is we just ran that app we just started. I can slide back and forth. I got that nice, silky, smooth kind of panorama experience. And you know, without having to write any code, I got a basic app up and running. Now, let's actually do something a little bit richer. What I want to do is build a simple data snacking application that's going to consume some data from eBay. And allow me to see some sort of hot auctions that are currently closing on the site. And so to do that, I'm going to do a couple things. The first is I'm going to go into my XAML view and update my UI subtly here to begin with. I'm going to change my header, so instead of first item, we'll make this something a little easier like, say, hot deals. You notice as I change my source, my design view updates. Likewise, if I change my design view, the source will update. Because we're going to be showing auction items, I'm going to get rid of the kind of default list box that's in the template by default, And instead, I'm going to add one that's actually going to show off some auction data. And so here's basically a list box I just added. It's got a data template inside there with some data binding expressions. I got an image control and a couple text blocks there. And now all I need to do is write some code to retrieve some data and bind against it. Now, you can use a variety of different ways to get data with Windows Phone 7. You can use web services, you can use REST, you can use JSON. One of the things I'm excited to announce today is we're shipping a new OData library that you can take advantage of. And that allows you to use standards-based OData to consume data and query data on the web. And it turns out eBay actually has a OData endpoint now exposed. And I'm just going to basically reference our new OData library as well as a simple eBay wrapper that we've created to save me a little time. And all I'm going to do then is write a little bit of code in order to call that eBay service and bind it against the list box. And so, here is three lines of code I'm doing. Again, all I'm doing is creating that eBay deals collection. I'm binding it to the list box, and I'm asynchronously loading it from that feed. And now, when I run this app again, my emulator pops up. Now, instead of having the default list, I now have a nice hot deals. People were wondering what's up with this. Someone asked me earlier, like, so is this something you wear? No, this is actually for my son, who's 4 weeks old. So anyway. I thought it was very odd that someone asked me that last night if I wear this, though. But anyway, you got a simple app up and running. Now, we could obviously go further inside Visual Studio and add a lot more features to it. In the interest of time, though, I'm going to skip ahead slightly and show a slightly richer version of the app. And I'm going to actually switch into Expression Blend, which is another free tool that you can download for phone development. And you can see here the nice thing about Blend is I can actually open the same project file format that Visual Studio uses, and I can actually have both tools working on the same app. And this is a sort of, again, advanced version of the tool of the app that we've been building, nicely skinned and stylized, and so it just looks a little prettier. You'll notice here I can even drill in things like this little fire. Instead of being a picture, it's actually a nice storyboarded animation. And so I can actually do all the animation timelines, all the customization directly. It makes it really easy in order to have a really nice looking app. Now, I can use the emulator in order to run the app, or I can actually just go ahead and hit F5 and deploy it directly to my phone device. And so you can see here now it's coming up on this phone. And now what I have here is my hot deals loaded. I got, you notice the nice flickering animation, and I got really nice smooth scrolling with a nice panorama style experience all on the phone. Again, you can deploy directly from the tools onto the device or use the emulator. So simple data snacking app that we've kind of built. Hopefully what it shows is kind of from start to finish how easy it is to get started. We've had more than 500,000 downloads of the tools already. Again, all the apps that Brandon showed, you can actually now build with these free tools and actually start uploading into the marketplace. So everything I show here so far is already shipping. What I want to do now is switch gears slightly and talk about some new capabilities that we're adding to the tools going forward as well. And specifically, I'm going to talk about and demo for the first time some nice profiling tools that we're going to be adding into the tool set. And what these profiling tools let you do is actually run an application on a real physical device, measure it, and be able to identify any performance bottlenecks that you have within the application. And better yet, this profiler is kind of pretty user-friendly, and it'll actually help pinpoint the problems within your apps and help identify how to fix it. And so to kind of show this off, let's actually switch to this other machine, which has the profiler loaded. And so this is a slightly updated version of the app again. The difference here is I actually added some bugs. So I added a bunch of perf bugs into that app just to kind of simulate why a profiler is pretty useful and some of the capabilities that this one in particular that we're building provides. Now, what it means is instead of just hitting F5, I can now actually go ahead and just say I want to start this performance analysis tool. So what I'm going to do here is run that. And what this will do is this will basically deploy the app, an instrumented version of the app, onto the device. And so we switch now onto the device here. You can see it just loaded. Again, this is the version of the app that has some performance bugs, so this is by design. But you'll notice here that the scrolling is not nearly as smooth. It's a little glitchy there. Again, that's because I added some bugs into it. But the nice thing is the profiler is capturing all the data. And so when I actually exit out of this and switch back to my profiler, What it's doing right now is basically, notice it stopped. It's actually going to analyze the profile data, and it's going to give me a profile analysis report as to what exactly happened. And what you're seeing here is, at the top level, just a summary data. It's actually looked throughout this, the time we were running that app at the frame rate that was actually being painted on the screen, and it's identifying what the frames per second were. Green means the frames per second is pretty good. Red means bad. We're also monitoring the CPU utilization on the box, and then also the storyboard animations that are firing throughout the app. And so you can sort of correlate, hey, everything was green here. We did something down here, and basically our frames per second, our CPU spiked. Now, what's nice about this is I can actually select any region within the overall summary and drill down to see exactly what's going on and what caused the problem. So I'm going to select this region here where we went from green to red. Scroll down here now, and you can actually see detailed stats on exactly how much time we're spending in the CPU versus the GPU on the box. You can also go ahead and see details where we actually look at your app and the instructions that are happening within the app and try to identify what was the problem. And so we have a bunch of friendly warnings here. We're basically saying, hey, there's 35 instances of this color animation running. That's probably a problem. You want to investigate it because it's bouncing you into the CPU. If we want to go one step further, so that would actually fix the problem, but if you want to go one step further, we can even drill in to actually see what are all the controls that are running in that particular selected scene. And I can actually see, highlighted in red, the controls where we look at the draw time or the layout time looks like it's actually consuming too much resources. And if I want to go one step further, I can even go down on a per frame basis. And so we can analyze each of the individual frames that occurred during that 20-second sample. You'll notice here, if I have some green, red means the frame's taken an awfully long time to render. And if I scroll down, you'll notice we'll actually show you at that particular frame every visual element that was being painted onto the screen, how much time was being spent in the CPU, how much time was being spent in the GPU, and the profiler's even smart enough to actually identify what we think are the likely culprits that are actually bringing the perf down and how to fix it. So this is an early sneak peek kind of at some of the profiling tools that's coming out. A lot more features are going to be added, but we think the combination of that plus all the other tools that we've already shipped really give you kind of an end-to-end experience both for building apps and really making them sing. So just to wrap up, today we saw a couple great applications that are already in the marketplace, and hopefully you saw just sort of the productivity and the ease of which you can actually build your own Windows Phone applications. The great thing is you can start building these apps, you can upload them into the marketplace, and you can start to make money. And there's a big opportunity there for the first couple apps that get into that marketplace. And you're going to see a lot more talks throughout this event on how to do it. So thanks a bunch. Hope you enjoy.
Yeah, we're early. There's no question we're early. And yet if you look at time of launch, we got more applications than the guys have been in the market now a while. But we need your best work. We think the tools are great. We think the phones are great. We think we're going to put the muscle behind the phones from a marketing and sales perspective to really help them sell. And we think there's just a phenomenal opportunity for people to get out there and build applications, both applications that have been conceptualized in other environments and on other phones, and a set of applications that really make sense because of the different pivot we've taken, every pun intended, the different pivot we've taken on how to really put the user at the center of the experience. On the cloud, which we'll talk about later, we're all in, but make no mistake about it. When it comes to Windows Phone, we're all in. I've gotten asked various questions, well, what will you do if this or that or blah, 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 blah. Boom, baby, that's what we're going to do. Continue to work. Continue to drive, continue to improve. But man, I think we got a great opportunity for you and for us with the Windows Phone. And I think the opportunity to get after it together and to build with the kinds of tools and the improvements that Scott had a chance to show and some of the applications Brandon had a chance to show really gives you something of a conceptualization. I had a chance 2 weeks ago, I was in France. And our French team had organized an event. They had invited developers from around France to show their Windows Phone applications. And you had to do a submission on Facebook, and then they took a vote, and then they brought in the seven guys with the most votes for kind of an American Idol-style judging competition. But I saw some of the most interesting applications, the fantastic work. I saw a lot of developers, in that case, building their Windows Phone applications with a Windows Azure backend, because that seems to be a very convenient thing for people once they're comfortable with our tool sets. It seems like a very logical thing that I'm sure many folks will choose to do. And I think the opportunities here are just fantastic. You can take a look at what some of the reviews have looked like. Some of them have been way off the charts, positive. Some of them have pointed out that we still have an opportunity to add a couple of features. But I tell you, just show a Windows Phone to anybody you know, and you're going to get a great reaction. For those of you, as I said earlier, for those of you who are here physically, you will actually get a Windows Phone. The distribution is in the registration area. Just load them up with applications. That's all I can say. You write those apps, drive them forward, but there'll be a range of different models from a range of the different manufacturers, and I think give you all a great opportunity to drive forward. Also, all paid attendees will get a free registration in the Windows Phone Marketplace, which is a $99 value. I wanted the opportunity to talk to you a little bit about Windows and Windows Phones and what we're doing. The other major part of the platform, and one where, frankly, I think we are really propelling the ship very quickly in terms of capability and really transforming from a world of on-premise or hosted servers to a world of platform as a service, is the work that we're doing with Windows Azure. The uptake, the adoption, the acceptance has been really phenomenal from developers around the world. Bob Muglia is going to have a chance to talk to you a little bit about what has happened and show you some things that are coming in the world of Windows Azure and SQL Azure. But it's certainly been a real pleasure for me to have a chance to talk with you today. I hope we have really piqued your interest. Take advantage of IE. Build those Windows Phone applications, and I think you're going to continue to fall in love with Windows Azure. Thanks, everybody, very much.
So the day was July 6th. 1992. It was the second PDC we'd ever run. First one was here in the Seattle area. And people remember that PDC as the Windows NT PDC. It was a very busy time for me personally. My daughter had been born less than a month earlier, and I had been working 12-hour days from before she was born right up through that day, something my wife will never let me forget, I'll say. But it was worth it, because it was a time when it was a dawn of a new era, and it was a time when we saw the industry undergoing significant change, and that change really was the advent of industry standard computing for servers. It was a change that brought applications to small businesses who could never see it before. It was a change that enabled big businesses to connect offices around the world in distributed systems and really go global, like they had never been able to do before. Ultimately, we saw it bring about and enable the internet to be possible, which of course runs on industry standard computers. So it's sort of appropriate that as we stand here today, a generation or so later, my daughter just happened to start as a freshman in college this fall, so it's 18 years later, where we see a new age really beginning. And a new age that I think will open up new possibilities that go beyond what we even saw 18 years ago. And of course, that age is really the age of the cloud and the age where new cloud applications will rule the land. And, you know, I wanted to talk a little bit about the cloud and the different sets of the different kinds of clouds that exist. People have been talking about this. It's getting standardized in a lot of ways. Conversations around infrastructure as a service, software as a service, and platform as a service. Now, Microsoft is a provider that has offerings in all three of these areas. We just announced last week Office 365, an important offering in software as a service. And next week, or week after next, at TechEd in Berlin, we'll be talking a lot about infrastructure as a service and how Windows Server and Hyper-V and System Center provide a fantastic solution for people who want to take and build private clouds and public clouds using infrastructure as a service. But today, what I really wanted to do was focus in on platform as a service, because I think it's very clear that that is where the future of applications will go. Platform as a service will redefine the landscape. And Microsoft is very focused on this. This is where we are putting the majority of our focus in terms of delivering a new platform. And of course, that platform is Windows Azure. And so let me talk a little bit about platform as a service and give you an idea of some of the characteristics of this, how it looks relative to existing applications. I think it's worth answering that question, because what is it that makes platform as a service so unique and different compared to existing applications and in existing environments? Well, let's look at today. First of all, if you look at today, all of us who are familiar with writing applications know that there's a lot of infrastructure we have to deal with. We think about the underlying server. We think about managing VMs. Now, in some cases, hundreds or even thousands of VMs. We worry about the network. We worry about the way the storage is configured. And then we can get to the app. Well, with platform as a service, all of that infrastructure is handled for you. And you, the developer, can focus on the app. What really matters, what matters to your organization, what distinguishes your business. In fact, you know, if you look at this, one of the ways you can tell for sure that something is platform as a service is if you're dealing with any of that infrastructure stuff. If you're managing a VM, it's not platform as a service. And so you can focus on what really matters to you and to your business, which is the app. Another interesting thing about the platforms today is that you're dealing a lot with change that isn't really helpful to you. Change in the form of patches that happen on a frequent basis. Change in the form of service releases. New versions that come in and give you some features, but also tend to bring with it some incompatibilities and issues you have to deal with. Well, with platform as a service, all of that is maintained for you. The entire operating system environment is maintained, and it improves and enhances over time, gives you new features and new capabilities, but it stays compatible. It's maintained. You worry about your application. With today's world, there's a lot of assembly required. You have to take pieces from all over the place, put them together. You want this middleware component. You want this set of services. You want this runtime, this library. You put it together. You assemble virtual machines. You test the image out and deploy it. That's all a lot of work. In the case of platform as a service, there are a whole broad set of highly available scale-out services that are just available to you to call. Again, you just focus on what matters to your business. And these services become things that make you much more productive and allow you to get your applications into market much, much faster. Now, I'll point out that the top three things I listed here are advantages for platform as a service, even relative to new infrastructure as a service offerings. Platform as a service has distinct and unique advantages, which is why we see it as the destination for where tomorrow's apps will be written. But let's talk, because people aren't living in even an infrastructure as a service world, let's talk about the world today that almost all of us live in. One of the attributes is the data center environments. I've been to a lot of data centers, and they're all different. The environments, the software, the hardware, the different kinds of networks, the different kinds of topologies, they're all different, they're custom, and they're very inconsistent. You know, I find it's interesting, in some senses, the industry is providing one after another complicated solution to fix problems created by yesterday's complicated solution. So one of the great opportunities we have with platform as a service is to get rid of all that grunge and focus instead on a standardized environment, a standardized hardware environment, a standardized operating system environment that, again, enables you to focus on what matters, the app. In today's world, applications need to be designed to handle the peak load, whether that's an end of quarter time or whether it happens just before Christmas, whatever the period of time when an application is under its most stringent demands, the infrastructure has to be provisioned to be able to handle that because it needs that level of resource. With platform as a service, scale is available on demand based on what the application requires. And in many cases, with a global provider like Microsoft, that scale is even available globally, allowing you to reach parts of the globe that you never could easily reach before with your applications. And sort of finally, for years and years, applications have been designed to focus on avoiding failure. People were afraid of applications failing because it had business impact. So an enormous amount of work goes into focusing on keeping the system from failing. And when a system does fail, it can be a crisis where people are paged in the middle of the night and they come in to fix a database or a disk that's been corrupted. Well, platform as a service takes a very different design point. It recognizes that failure will happen. Failure will happen within components of the application. Failure will happen certainly in the hardware. And it's designed to be able to keep the application up and running through failure. So when something fails, it's no big deal. Another instance is just spun up. When a network connection or a network switch goes down, it doesn't matter because there are other instances running everywhere. So that's the kind of distinction that we see with platform as a service, and it's why we're so excited about it. It's why we're putting our energy on it, and it's why we're building Windows Azure. Windows Azure was designed to run as the next generation platform as a service. It is an operating system that was designed for this environment. And let me really talk about it for a second as an operating system, because first and foremost, that is what Windows Azure is. Now, if you're only focusing on the infrastructure, I can understand why you might be confused and think that an operating system isn't important. But if you're trying to build a platform as a service that provides from top to bottom capabilities, all the way from the hardware infrastructure, all the way up through a set of services to enable applications, you need an operating system. That's what operating systems do. They manage the underlying hardware and they provide services to applications. Now, if we look back over time, I talked about the Windows NT PDC and the introduction of Windows NT. It was an operating system for its time. It was designed to run on a server, a computer. Well, Windows Azure is an operating system for now. It's designed to run on hundreds or even hundreds of thousands of computers. It's designed to run an entire data center, and it's designed to run across multiple data centers around the globe. It's been designed to work in today's cloud environment and to provide a very broad set of services to applications. And with that, let's talk about those services. If you look at what we're doing with Windows Azure, we're moving. I mean, one of the themes of today is there's amazing focus and within Microsoft on Windows Azure and across the industry on what can be built on top of this next generation operating system. And what we've done with Windows Azure is we have focused on building a very integrated, highly comprehensive platform of services that are available for you to write your application. So if you want to, for example, use Facebook or Google or an Active Directory, a corporate Active Directory, as your authentication source, there's a service to enable that. It's a couple of lines of code for you. The service is up and running. It's a scale-out multi-tenant service, it's available. If you want to speed up your applications, your web applications, and get pages out faster, we have a shared coherent caching service that's available to you. It's just a couple of lines of code. And all of these services are designed to work together. We've been working on them for a long time. They're not some set of ragtag acquisitions that we've acquired in the last 12 months and just thrown together. These are a set of comprehensive services that we know you need to develop this next generation of PaaS application. And the services are built on technologies and products that you know really well. So Windows Azure and SQL Azure, they're built on Windows Server and SQL Server. Those are environments that you have a strong understanding of. And they've been enterprise tested for decades. So they start out with incredibly broad capabilities that are clearly ready for the most demanding applications. Of course, things like .NET and world-class tools like Visual Studio and operational management tools like System Center, all of these are being designed to work together, building on the strength that they've had for so many years, meeting the needs of the most demanding business applications, but now being re-engineered for the cloud. So what we've done with these products is it's not like we've just moved them into Windows Azure and are running them in a VM. We're not doing that. We are saying to ourselves, what does the cloud require of the underlying platform? What does it have to deliver? Well, it needs to deliver a fully available, globally scaled, shared, multi-tenant service. And that's how we're redesigning these underlying services as a part of Windows Azure. So take SQL Server and compare it to SQL Azure. SQL Server was designed to run on one server or perhaps a cluster of servers that work together. That's not how SQL Azure was designed. Sure, it's SQL Server underneath. It's the same SQL engine underneath. It's the same stored procedures and the same T-SQL. All that's the same. So from the developer perspective, it's the same in database environment. But underneath, SQL Azure runs on thousands of computers across multiple data centers, currently 6 data centers globally. And data is replicated across those things, and all of that is handled for you. You don't think about it. You don't think about how you're allocating files and how you're building up underlying physical infrastructure. SQL Azure handles that because that's what a real PaaS database system should do. And so we built these things based on their strength, but made them world-class for this next generation of the cloud. And yet, while that is true, the underlying platform that we're creating with Windows Azure is a very open platform that's been designed to enable you to run the language of your choice, the framework of your choice, the development tool, management tool, or in fact the data center. With the Windows Azure appliance that we introduced this summer, we're taking Windows Azure that we're running as a public cloud at Microsoft, and we're making it available to customers and partners to run in their data center environment. So very important thing, everything you hear at the PDC this morning and over the next few days, all of the sessions, when we talk about Windows Azure and what services we're making available to Windows Azure developers, those services will be available also within private cloud data centers that run Windows Azure. So if your organization wants that kind of environment, these same set of services will be made available to you. But the success of Windows Azure in the long run does provide you with this kind of choice, the choice of data center, the choice of language. We're making Java a first-class citizen with Windows Azure. The choice of the underlying framework, the choice of the development tool. Sure, we'll show Visual Studio. We'll talk about how great Visual Studio is. But we're working hard on making Eclipse great to build applications against Windows Azure. We'll make PHP great. We'll make Groovy great. We're focusing across a broad set of underlying environments. So you can choose the environment that best suits your application because Windows Azure is a general purpose platform as a service. And in fact, if you take a look, it's the only general purpose platform as a service on the planet. So what that leads us to is that we're providing these set of services in Windows Azure so that you can focus on what matters to you, which is the application and ultimately the business problem you're trying to solve. Because all this other stuff are services that in the past used to just get in your way. All that infrastructure, it just got in your way. Our job is to get that stuff out of the way and enable you to get applications written as fast as you possibly can, get them in live and into the market, get data back on them and learn, and then to be able to respond to that data very quickly. It's all about applications, and in particular, it's about your applications. So that's kind of the rest of the theme of today. Today is about applications and all the sets of services that are coming in Windows Azure. And what I wanted to do was show you a video and give you a demonstration of an application that you might not be familiar with, but I can tell you for sure that the end product of this application everyone is familiar with. The characters it's created, the way it's animated people, the whole worlds that have been created because of this application is something that we've all been familiar with. But I'll tell you, the company that builds it is a household name. Let's go ahead and run the video. Please welcome Chris Ford from Pixar Studios. Chris, good morning.
Good to see you, Mark.
Great. It's great to have you here.
Hi, everyone.
So tell us about RenderMan.
So I'm sure when you all think of Pixar, you probably think of us as a feature animation film studio, and we are. But you may not be aware that we also pioneered the visual effects rendering technology that lies behind the visual effects revolution that has occurred over the past 20 years. This technology, called RenderMan, sometimes photorealistic RenderMan, because it can create images at such high levels of photorealism that you can combine them with live action in a seamless manner, is both an interface standard, it's also a product. And it's one that we use not only for all our films, going back to Toy Story, but when we also supply to the entire visual effects industry. In fact, any visual effects blockbuster you've seen, going back to Jurassic Park, pretty much uses RenderMan in some form or another. The last 16 Academy Award winners for visual effects use RenderMan. And today, about 70 to 80% of all VFX movies use our software, so we're pretty much the standard.
And it's really, it's not just the monsters and things like that, right? I mean, RenderMan is really used almost everywhere for much more subtle things, right?
Yeah, I think the key thing here is that it's cinematic quality images. That is, images where photorealism is paramount. So it is used in, for example, visualization, in broadcast, television, in high definition. All of these require that cinematic level of detail.
That's great. So why is the cloud important for RenderMan?
Well, I think what I need to describe is the magnitude of the problem. Let's just take one of our films. Toy Story 3 is our most recent. This is a 103-minute movie. At 24 frames a second, that is about 148,000 frames. Oh, you want it in 3D? You want to wear glasses in stereo? That's 290,000 frames. And each of those frames at the moment will take 8 hours on average to render. So you can see this is a big computational challenge. Now, that type of quantity requires a lot of resources. If we just had one processor, it would take us approximately 272 years to render a movie. Now, I'm not sure about you, but we're not that patient. So generally, if you're a studio, you'll have a large data center called a render farm. These days, averaging 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 processors or many more to calculate the final movie. But even then, it still takes, you know, weeks, months to generate all those final frames. But the real story here isn't so much about large studios who are already invested in their data centers. It's more about medium-sized studios and other content creators who really want to access cinematic rendering, but they can't afford the expense of a large render farm. And this is where we're particularly excited about the prospect of the cloud and Azure, that essentially a small studio with very creative people can upload their assets and gain access to hundreds, thousands of processors without actually having to pay for a physical installation.
So the cloud lets RenderMan come to places that it never went to before, never could get to before, because the cost was just not, it was too expensive.
Absolutely. Yes, I mean, there is, at the moment, you know, an ongoing diffusion in visual effects and graphics production and a growth in that production, especially outside of the USA, you know, on a worldwide basis. And always the cost of building the infrastructure is a key limiting factor. And the cloud has the potential to actually change that equation.
So, Chris, what led Pixar to Windows Azure and choose Windows Azure as the cloud platform?
I would actually summarize it at three main points. First is scalability. You know, the idea of a physical render farm with a render for hire type service is not new. It's been done many times before. But that's the whole point. It's a physical farm. It's a finite resource. The whole point about the cloud is its extreme elasticity. The fact that you can scale it to enormous sizes, which means that you could potentially push jobs through extremely quickly just because it's very wide as well as it is very deep. Second is sustainability, and this is very key for us. Remember, we're in a business where production timescales can sometimes take, you know, 2 years or more.
Right.
We need to ensure that a solution we put in place is going to be there in a few years' time. You know, confidence is a key part of the value proposition. So that's critical for us. And thirdly, frankly, it just works. You know, we just uploaded the HPC Windows version of RenderMan up into the cloud, and it worked.
Works,
we
great.
Didn't have to do anything else at all. So we can focus on what we do well, which is develop rendering software, knowing full well that we can run the same software in the cloud without any extra effort.
That's great. Let's take a look at it.
Absolutely. So what I'm going to show you here is a proof of concept demo that we did on Windows Azure with the assistance of Microsoft. And this is not necessarily what the actual final thing will look like, but it does give you a sense of the key elements that we think are important. What we're looking at, first of all, is not actually anything in the cloud. You're looking at a character some of you may recognize, our friend Buzz Lightyear, and he currently is standing inside Maya. Maya is a 3D application which is very commonly used in the production industry to aggregate all of the scene assets that will be uploaded for the final render process. What I mean by that is all the models, the sets, the backgrounds, the vehicles, and also the light sources and the cameras that are positioned relative to those assets. All of that is embodied into one big scene description file called a RIB file. This is a RenderMan standard file. And these files can get pretty large because you've seen the scenes in many movies these days are pretty complicated. So Buzz essentially is written out as a RIB file, and then we get to the stage we want to upload it into the cloud. So this kind of shows you the experience, what it looks like. First of all, it should be simple, right? It should be clean and it should be attractive. It's on the web, as we see here. And what I do, of course, is I first of all enter my account area, so I know my work is safe from prying eyes, and I can create a new job. Now, you can see that there is already a job running on the cloud, but we also see that there's a history of those jobs that have been submitted in the past. But in this case, we want to submit a new job, so we need to upload that RIB file, which I mentioned earlier. So I'm going to choose it, and here it is, and we're going to upload. And as this uploads, there are a number of concepts I would like to relay, one of which is the fact that as we go through the file, it will start to identify if there are any changes. And if it sees changes, it will only upload those new elements that are required. In other words, we can analyze the file so we're not redundantly uploading the same thing time and time again, which of course is greater time and expense. Another key concept, which is implicit, is the concept of an estimator. Now, you must remember that we are dealing with a creative industry here. We have directors, we have designers, and they just love to change things. They just love to tweak things, normally right up in front of the deadline. And the elasticity of the cloud offers the potential to essentially be able to accommodate those changes very close to the deadline. So, for example, if you need it tomorrow, we can just increase the number of rendering units, if you like, which are purchased, and you can see that the estimated rendering time here goes way down. Now, there'll be a price attached to that, of course, so equally you can take the more economical path and you have a longer rendering time. The whole point is that here we're really leveraging the elasticity of the cloud to give us all of these options, which I think is pretty exciting.
So what's actually happening here is when you uploaded the file, what you did was you were uploading the RIB file into Azure Blob Storage.
That's right.
And then as you choose the different tiers of rendering time, that will determine the number of worker roles in Azure that actually work on this particular job simultaneously.
Absolutely.
And the job, RenderMan is a C++ application,
absolutely,
Windows C++ application that you were able to just quickly move to Windows Azure.
Yes. Yeah, it was extremely easy. So once we've selected the number of rendering units we're going to use, I'll just enter the name of the output image file names that will come from the renderer, and I'll start the job. And here we are rendering. Now, there are 1,440 frames in this sequence, and I will admit that watching rendering is not often the most exciting thing. But what is interesting is seeing the frames come out. So while this is actually rendering, we can go to the job details, and you can see each of the frames begin to pop out as each one finishes. These little proxy images, most importantly, will enable us to see if there's anything going wrong. So, of course, at any time, we can cancel the job and we can start again. But we can see the completion time is printed here. And at all times, we're in control of the job. We know essentially how much it's going to cost, how long it will take. So finally, those jobs will just literally go straight down to your local hard drive, where you just simply put them straight out to film or to video or whatever output medium you're using. And you have a full record of all of the jobs that are submitted. Because remember, a visual effects shot or any sequence you're working on may be composed of many individual shots. You know, some of these can get quite complicated. All of us on Pixar's RenderMan team are really pretty excited about the prospect of the cloud to significantly alter the cost and production equation for this type of work. And I really would like to thank Bob, you, and Microsoft for all of your help in this proof of concept and really helping us share it with you here today. Thank you.
Chris, we really appreciate it. Thank you so much. We look forward to working with you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I love that example because it's something that we've all experienced. We've all seen what RenderMan can do and enjoyed it in so many many wonderful pictures that it has helped to create over the years. And it really speaks to the promise of the cloud because it takes something that was only previously available to the largest studios and now makes it available to really anyone who wants to create the next wonderful animated feature or, in fact, augment an existing regular motion picture. So coming back to the apps, it's all about the apps, and it's all about what we can do to help you be more effective in writing apps by providing wonderful new Windows Azure services. And this morning, what I'm going to be doing is talking about the broad set of new features that are coming in Windows Azure to make your job easier. And I'll talk about how those features can help you take your app and move them to the cloud, how you can enhance your existing applications, and then some new things that are very transformative in the way applications will be written with the cloud and platform as a service. And I'm going to start by talking about moving existing applications. And interestingly, I'm going to talk for just a minute about infrastructure as a service. It's the only feature I'm going to talk about this morning that is really an infrastructure as a service feature. And what we're now doing is bringing a VM role out on Windows Azure so you can take a Windows Server 2008 R2 image that you've built with Hyper-V in your environment and move that into the Windows Azure environment and run it as is with no changes. Glad to have that feature. And over the next year, we'll be bringing out Windows Server 2003, and we'll be enabling also image creation within the cloud. So we're treating this as something that helps you to take your existing applications forward. And we again, believe very strongly that the destination is PaaS, and the destination for applications are inside Windows Azure roles. But we know that many of you have applications that need some work in order to maintain or may not be worth taking that step. And so having this infrastructure as a service feature is a helpful transition there. Another feature that we're announcing today to help you move your application is something that allows you to take an existing application and move it to PaaS, and that's server application virtualization, Server App V. So if you're familiar with App V on the Windows client, what it does is it takes an existing Windows application that writes to the registry and does a whole lengthy, complicated install process, and it packages it into a file, which can essentially be X-copied onto a desktop. Well, we've taken that technology and now built it for the server environment and for the Windows Azure Cloud environment. And what it does is it lets you take an existing application and then deploy that application without going through its installation process into a Windows Azure worker role. And something we think it's a very exciting way to help you get compatibility with existing Windows Server applications in the cloud environment. We're also announcing a broad set of new features in Windows Azure. These are things you've all been asking for. They're important features that we've been waiting to have come. And by the way, these features that are on this page will be available later this year. So all these things go live this year. We'll be in beta on these features. Smaller instance of Windows Azure, so if you don't need a full role, a full core, you have a sub-core. Remote desktop capability, something I think everybody needs to be able to get access to the roles. Full IIS support, enabling a broad set of new applications, smooth streaming applications, and any number of websites on a single server, in a single role. Virtual network capability, which I talked about at PDC last year, called that Sydney, that will connect your existing corporate data centers and databases and information apps on your existing corporate data center virtually into the Windows Azure applications that you have. Admin mode, elevated privileges. Finally, it's a great feature that lets you take and install applications that require administrative mode and elevated privilege. Server 2008 R2 roles, so the latest instance of Windows Server now available in the role form within Windows Azure. And then support for multiple administrators to allow greater flexibility in terms of how you manage the environment. And so now to show you all of that, what I want to do is invite Mark Rasinovich to come on stage and talk about and show you some of the great new features in action in Windows Azure. Mark.
Hey, everybody. Well, let's start here on a site that I think a lot of you are familiar with. This is the Channel 9 website, of course. This is where you go to watch videos of developers talking about the products that they're working on. What you might not know, though, is that Channel 9 has taken a really big bet on Windows Azure. This used to be an application that ran on-premise on a server, and now it runs up in the cloud on Windows Azure. And what I'm going to do is take you behind the scenes of that application to show you how they've managed to do that by taking advantage of some of the features that Bob just mentioned. So let's go to the new Windows Azure Management Portal. Those of you that have used the existing portal, you'll probably see this as a little bit of an improvement. It starts here with this dashboard, which shows you at a glance the status and health of your various deployments, their roles, and their role instances. And then over here on the Compute Services node, you can get detailed information about all of those instances and those roles and those deployments. What I'm looking at here is the Channel 9 service. And that Channel 9 service consists of two roles. This first role here is the Memcached role. This is a worker role front end, which caches the Channel 9 content. And then you've got this role right here, which is a standard web role, the Channel 9 view role, which is actually hosting the website. There are two instances of that role. You can see those here for availability. And when I click on them, you can see buttons light up in the toolbar. I think the one that a lot of you will be excited about is this one right here, which I'll go ahead and press. And if you've ever had a problem with one of your services up in the cloud, and you've only had Windows Azure Diagnostics as your way of trying to figure out what's going wrong, then this button is the one you want, because it lets you, like Bob said, connect right inside a running role instance. So I'm going to run my favorite diagnostic and troubleshooting tool to show you around here, and that's Task Manager. No, come on, you thought I'd run Task Manager? This is, of course, SysInternals Process Explorer. And what you'll notice here, some of you might recognize the W3WP. This is the IIS worker process. This is full IIS. And if I click open the DLL view to show you some of the components loaded inside it, you can see that Channel 9 team is using some third-party components. If I scroll down here, and I've got to stop here. I didn't realize that Rhino's hibernated until I saw this, so I bet a lot of you didn't either. And what I'm really trying to show you here is this DLL right here, the Passport Relying Party Support DLL. This is actually the Windows Live Authentication COM object. It's a COM object that requires installation the first time the role starts up. It requires admin rights. And so I'll show you in a little bit how they were how they managed to configure that. As further evidence that this is full IIS, you've got iNet Manager here. If I click that open, you can go look at the website instance that Windows Azure created when the role started. Here it is. And if I click Explore, I get taken right to the root directory of that website installation. And the reason that I'm taking you here is to go into this startup folder. And this is where various executables and their support files are stored that get executed the first time the role instance starts up. The one of interest is this install RPS executable. And that's the one that installs that Windows Live ID COM object. So let's take a look at how hard or how easy it was for the Channel 9 team to set this up. And for that, I'll go back to my desktop, open up Visual Studio, and we've got the Channel 9 Windows Azure service loaded here into Visual Studio. I'm looking at the service definition file, and there's some new sections here, even if you've programmed in Windows Azure, that you haven't seen before. The first is this startup section, and this is where you configure the tasks that execute the first time the role instance starts up. This is the task that installs that RPS executable that we just saw. And it requires, as a COM object, admin rights, which it's given here with the elevated value on the execution context property. If we scroll down a little bit, this is where the website's defined. And it's got standard HTTP and HTTPS port bindings. You notice it's in a section called sites, and that's because it's as easy as copying and pasting this code to create another website. Just have to give it a new name, and I've got another website. So it's taking advantage of some of the full IIS features. It exposes a number of other powerful IIS features like virtual directories, virtual applications, and you can even do things like create custom host headers, which that's supposed to auto-complete. There we go. Well, that should auto-complete. Let me scroll down a little bit further and show you one last thing here. This is the import section, and that's new. This is where you configure Windows Azure plugins to be run in your service when it starts up. And I've got one plugin configured here. It's the Remote Access plugin. And that's what we used, actually, when we terminal servered into the, or RDP'd into the running instance. But the Channel 9 website is more than just that front end. As you know, that there's a lot of videos hosted on the website. And they've got a big job in encoding those videos that they capture into 8 different formats that they publish. That video encoding process is centered around this file share, which is on a server on-premise. And the way that the encoding process kicks off is that a video is dropped into this incoming folder. And the way that videos are dropped into that incoming folder is using this tool right here. I'll drop a video in there, and then we'll talk about what happens when a video gets placed there. And let's give our video a name. I'm going to do some search engine optimization because I want people during web searches to come to Channel 9 and watch videos. So I'll give it a name that I think will be picked up on a lot of searches. I'll submit that video. And now that job is going to be picked up and executed. But the way that happened in the past is that there's a Channel 9 encoding client that ran on that server, picked up the job, encoded it into the multiple formats, and then uploaded it. The problem with that architecture is that back around events like the PDC and TechEd, there are literally hundreds of videos that need to be encoded for uploading, and if just that server was responsible for it, it would literally take days to get those videos up into the cloud. So what the Channel 9 team has done in the past around those events is provision additional servers, even take machines from home, even take their children's PCs and bring them in. And there's nothing worse than a child waking up in the morning not be able to check on Justin Bieber's status. So thanks to Windows Azure, though, that's not going to happen tomorrow. And let me tell you how they did that, because this is a legacy application that they wanted to burst into the cloud to help offload that share. So they needed to get that Windows, that media encoder client software up into a Windows Azure service, but they faced two challenges in doing that. The first is that application requires manual configuration. They haven't had a chance to update it yet to be scriptable for its install. And the second is that they need, obviously, to connect back into the Channel 9 domain and get access to this share so that the worker, or so that the role instance can get pull that video up. And they also need to connect back in with credentials that are valid in the Channel 9 domain. You can see only Magic Folder users have access to that share. So let's talk about how they managed to address those two challenges in getting their application migrated to the cloud. And for that, I'm going to go back to the management portal and take a look at the Magic Folder Encoder service, which we see right here. It's got one role, the Magic Folder Encoder role, and its role type is different than what we see for the other ones. It's the special VM role that Bob mentioned. This means that the Channel 9 team was able to take a Hyper-V VM, install the encoder client, configured it, take a snapshot, and then go upload it to the cloud. You can see the VHD here, and then connect the service back to it. So that's the way that they addressed the first challenge of the client application requiring manual configuration. As far as the second one, being able to connect back into the Channel 9 domain with Channel 9 credentials, they leveraged this new feature, the virtual networking feature. And the way that this feature works is that, again, this is Project Sydney from last year. It's called Windows Azure Connect. That with the Windows Azure Connect plugin, these role instances, as they start up, get automatically joined to the Channel 9 domain and given fully qualified Channel 9 domain names. Now, I could show you connecting into those instances the way that we did before by going back and pressing the connect button. But to demonstrate that they really are part of this domain, I'm going to copy the short name of this server and then RDP right into it using that. Now, the way that that connection was made between the cloud and on-premise, like I said, part of it was that Windows Azure Connect plugin, which was specified in the service definition file. But here, the connections between the two, the on-premise and the cloud resources, are configured. You've got a group here, which is the Channel 9 domain, with the on-premise resources. This is the server that hosts that file share. And it's set up with a connection back up to the cloud in this role instance. Oh, and let me type in my credentials. And with that, the connection between the cloud is automatically made. It's as simple as configuring in the service definition file admin credentials for an account that can join back in. And now when that login actually takes place, we'll be able to see the Windows Magic Folder client software encoding that video that I dropped in there. And this will take a second because we're actually making a round trip back into the Channel 9 domain. And further, I'm going to be able to double-click on that file share, which is visible right here. There's the encoding software running, taking that job. Here's that that share on the Magic Server server back here on the Channel 9 domain. And if I double-click in, we're able to see the files that I had there you saw from on-premise, just as if this was down the hall. So we've got the full connectivity back into the Channel 9 CorpNet. So that is a look at Channel 9, how they took advantage of a lot of the features that we announced today to be able to get the Channel 9 application up into the cloud and get their encoding process bursted up into the cloud as well. Thanks, Bob.
Thanks, Mark. So a lot of great new features in Windows Azure that I think came from feedback from you of features that you needed and wanted to make it easier for you to take your applications and bring them up in the Windows Azure environment. And you know, as I said, this is all about applications. And we thought it'd be interesting to show you an internal application that we're working on, a Microsoft app that we're working on and we'll be making available in a CTP form next year, which is Team Foundation Server. So an application that many of you are familiar with, they're developers writing code, working together in teams. Today you need to install Team Foundation Server locally within your environment. We will be bringing Team Foundation Server out into the Windows Azure environment, and I thought that'd be very helpful for you to know that we're doing that. But we also thought it would be interesting for you to get a better feeling for what it's taken us to take what is a pretty substantive application and get it running in the Windows Azure environment. And so with that, I'd like to invite Brian Harry up, our technical fellow and chief architect of Team Foundation Server. Brian.
Thanks, Bob. I appreciate it.
The Team Foundation server is the heart of Visual Studio Application Lifecycle Management. It's, it sort of enables collaboration between all the people involved in creating software. And what I'm going to show you is sort of, we've been working on it for the last few months. I first talked about it on my blog a few months ago. And I want to show you how far we've gotten and talk a little bit about what it's taken. So let's start by talking about what it might take to get started using Team Foundation Server in the cloud. So let's start a trial and pick a project name that I want to use. Create my account. Now, I'll log in.
Using your Yahoo ID here.
Using Yahoo.
I guess they're a partner of ours. That's okay.
Indeed. So as Bob mentioned, today you have to install Team Foundation Server on premises. And you know, we worked really hard in Team Foundation Server 2010 to make that really easy. And we were very proud to get to the point where you could get from the time you sort of, you know, stuck in the CD to up and running was about 20 to 30 minutes. With the cloud, we're done. I'm done. My project is now provisioned. It's ready for me to use, and it takes about 20 seconds. No software to install. Simply say you want an account, and you're ready to go.
Plus, developers get access really from anywhere with us.
You can now use, you know, your global friends can now connect to the project and use it. So that's kind of what getting started would look like. What would it look like to use it? Is it a completely different experience? Well, let's start like any good developer would do and launch Visual Studio. The first thing you'll notice is that it asks me to sign in. And Team Foundation Server today, of course, only supports Active Directory authentication. Using AppFabric access control services, we're now able to support a bunch of different authentication mechanisms. Things like Live ID, Google, Yahoo, Facebook, and we can even federate with your corporate identity. So you can use your corporate identity to connect to TFS. So let's sign in with Yahoo. And here we go. We're in Visual Studio. It looks like Visual Studio. It's connecting to TFS. And it really is no different than your, you know, TFS as you know it today. I can open up my work items and see what work I have to do. That's all coming down from the Azure cloud. I can browse my source code, go find a project that I'd like to work on, and open that in Visual Studio just by double-clicking it. That downloads it from the Azure cloud onto my desktop, opens it in Solution Explorer, and there it is. The project's open. I can, you know, build that code. I can run my unit tests. I can do whatever I do to get things ready. And I have some nice sample code that I've modified here to show you what a check-in would look like. So I've got some changes. I'm happy with them, and I want to do a check-in. I just click check-in. It's going to upload that into the Windows Azure Cloud, and again, completely seamless inside Visual Studio. Nothing special.
Nothing different.
Yep, no different. Now, it happens to be that with this project on my Windows Azure TFS instance, I've configured it for continuous integration. Continuous integration is a process whereby every check-in is built, run unit tests, run static analysis, whatever it is you'd like to do to validate the code that you check in. So I can, as I checked that in, it automatically kicked off a build on the new Windows Azure VM role, and that build's right here in the queue. And if I open up that build status, I can see that it's been in the queue for 8 seconds. I can look at the build details, and I can watch.
It's doing a build in the cloud in Windows Azure, and in this case, it's using the VM role, and that's really useful because we know many of you have very custom build environments.
That's right.
We'll also have a more standard build environment that'll just use a standard Windows Azure Worker role to actually do the build.
Right. So, you know, that's it. That's sort of the developer experience. Completely transparent. I don't have to have any local the development infrastructure. It's all in the cloud. My TFS, my source code, my work items, my builds, everything's in the cloud. So that's cool. It's very simple for the developer. But as I mentioned at the beginning, TFS is about enabling collaboration among all of the people involved in the software development process. And there are a lot more people than developers. And we have a lot of interfaces involved in Visual Studio Application Lifecycle Management. We have a web interface. We have this here, Microsoft Test Manager, which is for test professionals who want to be able to do test plans, execute test cases, track the quality and the test progress. That's set up here, connected to that exact same TFS project running on Windows Azure. And apparently I don't have permission, but okay. We'll even enable our Eclipse client. So we have an Eclipse client for TFS that connects, and that will also work with
So anything that TFS works with today will just work in the Windows Azure environment with the hosted TFS.
That's right.
That's great.
So, you know, totally transparent experience. Now, let me take one moment to sort of talk to you a little bit about, behind the scenes, under the covers, what it's taken for us to do that. TFS started, of course, as a pretty standard web application with the standard three-tier architecture. As we moved that to the cloud, we took our web application pieces, which were our web services and our web UI. Those moved pretty transparently into a web role in Windows Azure. We've taken our background processing, which we call our job agent, that moved very easily into a worker role. We've taken our TFS build component, and that, as Bob mentioned, can run in a VM role. You'll also be able to do it in a worker role. We took what was in on-premise SQL, and that has now been partially moved to SQL Azure, and part of it moved to the Windows Azure blob storage. Now, some interesting questions about why we did that and how we decided what to move where. And later today, at 4:30, we're going to be doing a whole 70 minutes on sort of the process we went through importing TFS. So come if you'd like to learn more about that.
But this is a pretty significant application. I mean, a lot of stored procedures and a lot of code, right?
Yeah. TFS is a large application. The SQL Server especially, it's almost 1,000 stored procedures, over 250 tables, and about 180,000 lines of T-SQL. We were able to port all of that to SQL Azure in about two people in 1 month. So, and then on the web tier, it's about 350,000 lines of C# code, and that took one person 1 month to get it running on Windows Azure.
And in fact, I mean, I think one of you said one of the more complicated things was taking what was a single-tenant organization and application and making it multi-tenant, because that's something that is necessary for this kind of app.
Yeah, that's by far the biggest chunk of work we have. Getting it to run on Azure was not hard. It's turning it into a service that we can operate 365, 24 hours a day. That's the more challenging part.
Well, I think the insights that you've gained in terms of moving an existing application onto Windows Azure and then doing the things like taking advantage of the different identity providers and then making it multi-tenant will be very useful for people this afternoon. Yeah. That's great. Thanks a lot, Brian.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you so much. So this is a great example of how we're looking at what it takes to help you take existing applications and move them into the Windows Azure environment. And one of the key attributes of this is how we can help by providing a very broad set of highly scalable, always available, multi-tenant services that you can just incorporate into your applications with a couple of lines of code. And we have some great new services and some great new features that we're announcing today. The Access Control Service is supporting more providers, things like Facebook and Google, obviously things like Active Directory for corporate access, and of course Windows Live as well, and a broader set of protocols, particularly the OAuth protocol. We're pleased that the AppFabric Caching Service, which has been available on Windows Server since earlier this year, is moving to Windows Azure and will be available later this year for you to start working with. And it's just available for you to take and have a highly available persistent cache to accelerate your applications. Incredibly easy to get fantastic performance. Service Bus is being enhanced with durable message support on the ability to connect through BizTalk to existing business applications. That's a huge feature in terms of enabling a broad set of applications that require the consistency and stability of a durable message queue. SQL Azure, got some great new things coming in SQL Azure. Reporting services, a fully available set of SQL Server reporting services, now hosted as a multi-tenant service that all you need to do is just call and create reports against SQL Azure, you know, something that people have been asking for a long time, as well as data sync capability to synchronize multiple instances of SQL Azure within the cloud, but also to synchronize your on-premises SQL servers to SQL Azure running in the cloud, being able to connect your existing data center. And of course, that works very well with the virtual private network connection that allows you to take a particular database server and connect it to a particular Azure application within the Azure cloud. So a lot of great new features that are available for you as developers to begin using. And so with that, what I'd like to do is invite Don Box and Jonathan Carter up to show you some of those great new features in action.
Hello, how are you guys? Are you awake? Keynote's gonna be over at some point, I'm sure, by 4:30, because Brian said he's gotta talk, so I know we'll be done by then. Thanks for coming to PDC. It's great to be here in Los Angeles, in Boston, in New York, in London, all my favorite cities. I get to program in all these cities at once. This is my friend Jonathan Carter. What we're gonna do is write some programs against this notion of a platform as a service. Bob just talked about it. He showed you a list of some of the platform services that we provide, that we operate, that you as a developer don't need to think about, so you can just focus on writing your app mostly the way you do now, using the tools and languages that you're used to. So what we're going to do is take an app that we've got done a little bit of work on, and we're going to go add some more platform services to it. So Jonathan, can we go to Visual Studio? So what we've got here is a classic ASP.NET MVC application that we've written. And what we're going to do is actually deploy it to Windows Azure. What we've done in preparation for this is we've used the feature Vucinovic talked about earlier, full IIS. So we've got a virtual machine already deployed out into Windows Azure using full IIS. And what we're going to do is just use Visual Studio with Web Deploy to push our app out there. So rather than waiting for the standard staging of our deployment with web roles and worker roles, we can just use Web Deploy to get this thing up and running so we can do interactive development with our own private piece of the live cloud. And by the way, everything you're going to see today is against the live Azure bits. Great. So those of you who have written an MVC app before, this should look astonishingly familiar. We see the standard forms auth page. So what we do is we type in some credentials that are specific to our application. And what this application does is it says, what topics are you interested in? ASP.NET and OData, of course, right? And it helps you find people you can go talk to here at this event. And this app will actually be live. I mean, you can actually go use it if you want. So this app is running in Windows Azure right now. We instantly deployed it using Web Deploy. And it's using one of the platform services, which is SQL Azure. So all the data that we're fetching, which has all the tables of experts and topics and their information, is already been deployed out to SQL Azure. So the next platform service we want to add to this is the access control service. So remember when we started the app, we were using forms-based auth. So it was very specific. We had to manage all the accounts. We had to keep track of who could do what. What we're going to do now is use a platform service, which is ACS, to go set this up so we can use different kinds of logins. So what Jonathan is going to do is we've already kind of set up our app inside the portal to use several authentication providers. One of the authentication providers we're using is the Active Directory Federation service wired up to the Microsoft domain controller. So that if you're a Microsoft employee, you can come use our app using your standard credentials that you use every day when you log into Microsoft CorpNet. How many people in here have Microsoft CorpNet credentials? Show of hands. You're not supposed to be in this room. No employees are supposed to be in this room. I encourage you to consider whether you should be in here or not. How many? So that's an issue. Not many of you guys can use our apps because there were like five people who snuck in with their Microsoft CorpNet account. The other identity provider we're using is Facebook. How many people have Facebook accounts? Show of hands. In New York, raise your hands if you have Facebook accounts. In Tokyo, oh yes, I can see in Tokyo, everybody's got Facebook. It's awesome. Great. So everybody can get into our app because we're using Facebook. So we've set this up so that we can support both kinds of authentication in our app. But what we want to do is we're going to do some features that we want to only be available to folks who work at Microsoft. So what we're going to do is use ACS to add a claim so we can detect in our program whether or not you came in from a Facebook login or from a Microsoft login. So to do this, we're going to go in and add a new rule, which when we come in through the Microsoft Identity Provider, which you see at the top of the screen, we're going to add a new claim. The name of the claim is going to be role, and the value of that thing is going to be something clever, which Jonathan has just put in. It's called Softy. Great. So if someone logs in as a Microsoft account, we can just go look up in our identity information and see if the claim is present. If they come in from Facebook, it ain't going to be there. Great. So now what I want to do is go grab the address of our ACS service. And that address that Jonathan is copying off the web page is a platform service that we've deployed at Microsoft that we manage for you. You don't have to think about it. You can just use it. And so what we're going to do is go to Visual Studio and say add STS reference. And what add STS reference does is it allows us to say, look, we've got an application called RafikiDemo.cloudapp.net. This is the name of the app which we configured back in ACS before we came out on stage. And then we give it the address of the actual platform service that is being hosted by Microsoft, and we're set to go. So now, when we build and deploy the app, and by the way, every time he builds and deploys the app, we're actually pushing the bits back out to Windows Azure. So we're actually always running live in the cloud. The only thing that's not running in the cloud is Jonathan himself and Visual Studio. Those are running here on stage. Great. So now, when we get into our app, because we've wired it up to use ACS, instead of seeing the standard forms auth page, we're presented with the ACS logon page where we can pick one of the credentials. It looks like Jonathan has decided to use Facebook. Notice those of you who are watching carefully, it's jonathan.carter@lostintangent.com. If you would like to be ignored, you can add a friend request to Jonathan right now, and he'll be clicking all of his ignore buttons or accept or confirm later on. Great. So now that we've logged back into the app, we can type in whatever topics we care about. So ADO.net or ASP.net and OData, and we'll see the standard list of characters, including, of course, Pablo Castro. You can't have a demo without Pablo in it or without OData in it. Great. So we're set. We've already done that. So we've now used SQL Azure, and we've used ACS. So let's use another platform service. So one of the things we did was we wrote an OData server as part of the preparation for this demo, which talks to the Microsoft Exchange server inside of CorpNet here. So we can actually get access to the free busy information from Exchange, and we want to go make that available to our application. So what we did was we wrote an OData service that talks to Exchange, and then we stood it up on another platform service, which is the service bus. And the service bus allows me to put a name out into the global namespace of the internet and then use that as a relay point where I can send messages back and forth. So what we're going to do is go talk to that thing, and so when I click the show availability checkbox, that causes when we hit the find recommendations, to not only do the SQL Azure query, but to also send the OData requests over the message, the service bus, so I can get the information about free busy. And you can see because Jonathan did that, we got free busy information down below. But notice, up underneath the by four results found, it took about, what did that take? 2.391 seconds. That's actually faster than it normally runs. We got lucky today. Yeah. Sometimes it takes 10 seconds. Sometimes it takes 15 seconds. Usually it takes about 5 or 10. Great. So what's happening is we're going off and doing all these round trips back to the Microsoft CorpNet server that's serving up the OData information. What we'd like to do is use another platform service to make this thing go faster. So one of the new services that we're announcing today is the cache service. So we've got a cache service as part of our platform that you can use either in your on-premise apps or in your Windows Azure hosted apps, which is what we're building here. So we're going to go use that right now. So what Jonathan just did is he opened up our web.config file in our application. And notice that under the data cache client config section, we've identified where the cache service is that we're going to use in our application. And notice that the DNS name that we're using is actually in appfabriclabs.com. That's a part of the Windows Azure world over here that we manage. So we're going to go use that, and let's go actually write some code. So we're going to open up the program that is behind the Find Recommendations button. And we're going to write the code using the exact same code we would use if we were doing the on-premise caching technology called Velocity. Some of you folks in this room are probably using Velocity right now. This is basically a hosted version of that I no longer have to worry about deploying and managing. So we'll do the standard, go off and get a default cache. And the key for the cache entry, we're going to take that list of topics that you put into the text box. We're going to alphabetize it so we get a canonical key. And then we're going to use that as the key when we go off and do the lookup. So we'll do a cache.get using the key. And if we get back a non-null value, that means we got a cache hit. And if we got a cache hit, we don't need to go make those service bus calls. We can actually just use the cache results and return those immediately. So
So that's what we'll do here. Marshall by ref object. That's so old school.
I got away. Yeah.
That's awesome. You can have co-create free-threaded marshaller or something.
Oh yeah,
soon?
Little remoting
Excellent.
Code.
Great. We've done the cache hit. We've looked for it. If we got it, we did it. If not, we'll go ahead and do those service bus calls. And notice that we're doing basically standard OData calls using the OData URL, which is rafikidemo.servicebus.windows.net, which is where we stood up the service bus entries. And then we do a for loop, which is why it takes so long. You can criticize us for doing for loops across the internet, but whatever. And so now what we're going to do is, once we've got that information, we'll stick it in the cache. So the second time around, as long as you're looking for the same information, we'll be able to get a cache hit, and it'll go a lot faster. So Jonathan, are we done?
We're done.
So what we're going to do is, again, deploy it back out to Windows Azure and use yet another platform service. We'll log back in with our Facebook account. That's jonathan.carter@lostintangent.com.
I love friends, so it's fine.
The first 1,000 friend requests he will accept. After that, he's done. Great. So now, the first time we went out, this time it took 2.403 seconds. But the second time when we do the request, notice it took about 0.4 seconds. So this time we got a 6x speed up. And again, your mileage will vary. Typically, we get about a 10x. Great. So we've now added multiple platform services to our app. We've used SQL Azure. We've used ACS. We've used the cache service. And we've used Message Bus. There's one more service we're going to go use before we get kicked off the stage, and that's SQL Azure Reporting. So we've got a little reports tab up here. Why don't we go click it? Now notice that when we click the reports tab, we got a 401. We got an access denied. Let's talk about why we got that. Remember when we started this demo, we were in the portal, and we were configuring that if we came in through Facebook, we had one set of claims. But then if I came in with a Microsoft login, we got that extra claim, which was the role equals softy. So if I go look in my standard ASP.NET config, which has been around, you know, this is like 10-year-old config schema, and if I look at the location for the reports site, which is where we were just clicking, notice that we've got an authorization rule which says if you have the softies role, we'll let you in, and if you don't, we'll deny you. Because Jonathan was logged in with his Facebook credentials, he didn't have that claim softy, so he wasn't allowed in, which is why we got the 401. Right, so I was able to use that platform service to get my access control pretty trivially without writing. Actually, in this case, I didn't have to write any code. I could have programmatically looked for it had I cared. Awesome. So what we're going to do now is use SQL Azure Reporting. SQL Azure Reporting. I am not a great user of SQL Azure Reporting. Jonathan, are you?
Never used it once in my life.
Well, you're about to use it, Jonathan.
Except for right now.
I am going to walk you through gently SQL Azure Reporting. So what we did was we got someone we know who's an expert at SQL Azure Reporting to produce this beautiful report using the Business Intelligence Development Studio, also known as BIDS. This is the standard BIDS version that ships with SQL Server 2008 R2, standard file format, not unmodified tool. What we're going to do, though, is now we're going to take this report and we're going to deploy it not to a local server but to a SQL Azure Reporting service, which Microsoft maintains in the cloud. We don't have to maintain it. We don't have to deploy it. So we've just done the deployment, and now what we're going to go do is go to our ASP.NET app. We're going to go to the ASPX page behind that tab that we haven't been able to see yet, and we're going to actually go implement it. Now to implement it, we simply go grab the standard reporting services control, drag it out onto the ASPX page, and fill in a little bit of information. We're going to tell it what sizing to use, so we'll say width equals 100%, size to report content equals true. And then we're going to tell it, ooh, whoa, dude.
I was going local again.
God, look at that. So what we're going to do is say where to go, which cloud service to go use. This service has not been released yet, so this is a demo you cannot do. You can actually go use the cache service imminently. The reporting service is not up live yet, so we have a very funky-looking DNS name there. I promise we'll have one that's obscure but not quite this obscure by the time we're done. And we also say which particular report to go grab, so we get Rafiki/top-matched experts. Now, what we're going to do is go deploy the app one more time. And really, if you think about it, like we're deploying this app 5 or 6 times during this demo, right? And it's very interactive, very immediate experience. It's actually quite an advance from where we were at before. Notice now that when Jonathan logged in, do not hit sign in, please. Please, Jonathan. Hands away from the keyboard. Step back. Awesome. Great. Notice that when we logged in, we didn't log in with our Facebook credentials, because had we done that, we would have gotten the 401. Instead, we're logging in with our Microsoft credentials, and that's actually a page that's getting us into the Microsoft IT. And, okay, great, we're on the Microsoft campus, but we didn't have to be, right? We could have been anywhere in the world, and we could have used ADFS to get into the Microsoft CorpNet with our credentials and get an actual valid set of claims. So go ahead, Jonathan, you may now step back. Great. Hit sign in. So now when we log in, we're going to be logged in with our Microsoft credentials, which means we have that extra claim, the softy claim, which means I will be able to hit the reports tab, and drum roll. Okay, I've run out of drum roll breath. Notice that we get the familiar SQL Server Reporting Services dialog, but it's not being served up by SQL Server Reporting Services. It's being served up by the SQL Azure Reporting Service that we maintain in the cloud for you. Got it? So what we've seen is an ASP.NET app using the same tools, same technology that we're accustomed to using as developers, deployed into Windows Azure using a bunch of platform services. SQL Azure, Service Bus, ACS, the cache service, and finally, SQL Azure Reporting. Got it? So there you go. When you guys get back to the computers, please go write programs against this stuff so you can get the same experience that we just got, and I'd like to thank you very much. Bob? Thanks, Bob.
Thanks, guys. So lots of great services that are available for you to work with, and that's the whole point. How can we make it as easy as possible for you to focus on your application and focus on what only you can do, which is solve the particular issue and meet the customer need that you have in front of you. So we showed how these services could be worked with through standard coding. What I wanted, let me talk about some of the great things that are coming and how we can enable you to get these services that, and applications that you're writing out into the market. I want to announce today I'm announcing that we're going to make a marketplace available to you, the Windows Azure Marketplace. And in particular, what I want to announce is that we are going to make available to starting today the Windows Azure Data Market. We've been talking about Windows Azure Data Market in the form of Dallas for a little while right now, and we've been working broadly across the industry to get a large number of data providers up into the Windows Azure and SQL Azure environment and to bring that out to you. And today we're announcing that this is generally available. We have over 35 providers. It's actually now over 40 providers that are available live today, available for either free download or for purchase in the Windows Azure Marketplace, the data market aisle of that. And we are working with a lot of other providers that we expect to be online in the coming months. So this is an example of how existing applications and whole new applications can be written using new sets of services and tools that you've never seen before. And the data market is a great example of that. And all of this data is all available in a standard way. It's all available through OData for you to incorporate within your applications. It's all done in a very consistent fashion. So we're talking a lot about all of these different services, and now we have the data market service available. What I think is really interesting is how can we change the way applications are written, you know, in a PaaS world where you have this broad set of services that you can begin to work with. And as Don and Jonathan showed, you can take and do that by writing code to put the services together. But we also realized that we could run a service for you that would allow you to composite these different services together and essentially define the core, the backbone of an application, as a composite application that is managed through workflow. So what we're announcing today is with Windows Azure App Fabric, we're taking and creating something that's very, very new, a composition service that takes all of these other services that are available within Windows Azure and also available, frankly, anywhere else on the internet, because you can actually composite non-Windows Azure services, connect it together through a consistent workflow, and build the backbone of an application in this shared multi-tenant environment. You'll still be writing code to actually work with and manipulate those services, but essentially this is a declarative environment that builds the foundation of your application. And with that, what I'd like to do is invite James Kennard up to show you how App Fabric composition model and composition service can change the way applications are written. James.
Good,
see ya.
Good morning. I'm excited to be here today and show you a demo of the App Fabric composition model. Earlier you saw how Don and Jonathan quickly created a Windows Azure application that consumes several new services. They consumed caching, access control, even a new SQL Azure reporting service. What they effectively created was a composition of services. And in this demo, what I want to show you is how using Visual Studio, we're going to make it easier to build, deploy, and manage these composite applications. So I'll just minimize the application they created earlier, and I'll just drop into Visual Studio here. Inside of Visual Studio 2010, you'll notice that we're introducing this new project template. This is a distributed cloud application. What you also see is that I get this design surface where I can start building these relationships to services. Now, Jonathan and Don already did the work for me of writing that ASP.NET MVC application, so I'll just go ahead and pull that in here. And you'll see that in addition to our MVC app coming into Solution Explorer, we'll also get that application represented here on the composition model surface. Drag and drop that over. And of course, that application used a database in the cloud, a SQL Azure database. So I'll add that database here on the design surface as well. And so many of you in this room are probably familiar with data tier applications. Today, a capability in Visual Studio 2010 where I can represent my database, be it SQL Server or SQL Azure database.
That's the DAC capabilities that got added in SQL Server 2008 R2, right?
Exactly.
And SQL Azure now supports that. And here, with the App Fabric Composition Service, you can take and just configure that very directly.
Exactly. And so what I'm doing here is running through the same wizard you've already seen in Visual Studio, where I'm actually going out to the SQL Azure database, I'm reflecting on that database, identifying the tables, the stored procedures, all the other database objects. I'm actually pulling that in to have a database model as part of my app as well. What's interesting about this is coming back to the composition model is I can wire up that relationship from my web application to my SQL Azure database. And what I'm doing here is I'm making that relationship explicit. And you'll see a little bit later how because I have that relationship modeled here, we can actually automate some of the things you may do manually today, like setting up firewall rules, like setting up affinity groups. We can manage that in a more automated fashion. I'll add in the access control service that you also saw Don and Jonathan use earlier. And I'll just go into the property sheet. And here you can see I can turn on some of the properties for these services directly as part of Visual Studio, where they'll be captured as part of my model. I'll add in caching, of course, and draw that relationship, creating this dependency of my code to the application, the services I want to consume in the cloud. Now, what's interesting as I do some of these relationships, like caching, is that we can also automate some of the configuration behind the scenes, such as making caching the default session state provider for our ASP.NET MVC application. So what you see here is effectively the same app they created. What I'm just doing is making these relationships a little more declarative or a little more explicit.
And you're really doing it at the development time. You're really designing this essentially for how it will run within the production Windows Azure environment.
Exactly. Now, it'd be nice to actually add a little more functionality to the app they created. So for example, allowing the community to go submit to additional submissions for experts that should be in our database. And I'm sure there's many folks in this room that should actually be in that database as experts. And so I went and dropped an App Fabric container onto this design surface. What this container really does is it allows me to go and execute workflows in the cloud. This is a scalable, multi-tenant host for running workflows within the Windows Azure platform.
And that's a really important point James made. This is designed as a fully scale-out service so that you can run a very complicated workflow within the Windows Azure environment through this App Fabric container. You don't have to worry about whether the workflow will exceed the capacity of any given machine.
Exactly. You see, I've just dropped in my workflow into the container and wired up that relationship. You also notice that over in Solution Explorer, we have a new Windows Workflow Foundation project. Same exact project you're familiar with in Visual Studio today, and just using the Windows Workflow Foundation 4.0. What I'll do here, since many of you are using Workflow today, I'll just do Add Existing Item, and I'll just browse to the root directory here, and I'll just go ahead and pull in the XAML file that I've created earlier. So this simple workflow, as we open it up here in the designer, you'll see that it actually takes in that incoming request for adding an expert to the database, we'll send that off for review, and then receive back a confirmation whether we should accept or decline that given nomination. So a very simple workflow here. Now, what I really need to do, though, is wire up this workflow as part of my application. So I'll go over here to my home controller for my ASP.NET MVC app, and I'll just navigate down here to suggest an expert. Now, one of the important things that we've applied as a principle as we've been building out this composition model designer is that we don't want to do code gen as part of this designer. We want to leave your code in your control. What we want to do is just allow you to model those relationships so we can automate them as we move forward. So what I'll do here is I'll just go ahead and take this to full screen, and I'll just go ahead and type in here a little code snippet for starting approval workflow. And what this does is you see I take in some of the incoming parameters for my ASP.NET MVC app, and down below here, you see I can actually get access to that composition model at runtime. So this model is not just about drawing relationships within the designer. I can actually access it at runtime to get access to my connection string information, get access to my URLs for my services, and even change different aspects, like the metrics for our application at runtime.
So it's a very dynamic service, and because it's done through dynamic composition at runtime, what it means is that as your application is running, as you're learning from your customers what works, what doesn't work, different offers, things like that, you can much more easily modify your application to respond to those needs.
Exactly. So we have our application here, Bob, and so what I'm going to do is right-click on the Distributed Cloud app, and I'll select Publish to App Fabric. Of course, get a visual representation of what I just designed, but also go into a table view where I can see exactly each of the services that we're going to go and configure within the cloud, along with the default attributes and some of the ones I've overridden through the Property Designer. Now, in an enterprise environment, I would probably package this up and hand it over to some of my operations specialists. They would deploy it and manage it using all of the procedures that they have in place. And if I was an ISV, I would probably give this to my customers to deploy. In this case, I'm just going to use the self-service capabilities of Visual Studio, and I'll just select Deploy and Start here. Now, as I'm doing that, of course, we're doing a build and compile across all these different projects in the background, and we're also taking that model. We're then calling out to a new service in the cloud that you just mentioned, which is that composite app service. What this composite app service does is it effectively acts as a controller. It takes in that model that defines this relationship between our code and all of our services that we consume, and then it goes through and provisions and configures each one of those services, caching, access control, it configures the database as well. Exactly. And what you see here then is we get another view of our model, which is within a portal experience. Now, what I can do from here is drill into that web application and actually just click on a link to launch that web app. One of the important things to notice here is our application would start up very, very quickly. The reason why we're able to do that is because that comp app service, or that controller I just mentioned, is also managing a number of instances for us. So it's just taking instances out of a pool, allowing us to quickly spin up our application and launch our application.
Well, the composition service is designed just like all of the other services in Windows Azure, which is as a fully scale-out set of services that are always available for your applications. In this case, what we're doing is enabling you to put workflow and to put the design of an application within this composition service. But it's really consistent with all the way all the other services are designed.
Exactly. And so I can go over here to suggest an expert and, of course, kick off the workflow that we just designed a few minutes ago. Now, what I'll do is launch over here to Visual Studio. And inside of Visual Studio, I have a quick little test here that's going to simulate some load against our application. It's going to run some queries against our app. It's going to submit some additional nominations for experts. And so we can really see how our application behaves and making sure that our application is going to scale to our requirements. As I go and launch that test, I'll navigate back over here to the App Fabric portal. And you can see here, I get that visual view of our model again. But in this case, I actually have an alert. So what we're doing is that composite app service is using all that model information to know how to watch our application and alert us if there's anything that we should draw our attention to. In fact, if I just scroll down here, you can see there's a number of different metrics that service knows about our app because we've explicitly defined those relationships. I'll expand ASP.NET request, and you can see here that by default, we were configured to support 5,000 page requests. As our load test is running, we're obviously applying more than that to this particular application. So let's go ahead and correct it. I'll drill into the ASP.NET web app here, and I'll just change this attribute from 5,000. Let's just go ahead and crank it up to 15,000. Now, as I do that, what we're doing is we're scaling out our application to support this additional load by just taking some more instances out of the pool and continuing to execute our web application across those instances. I'll just navigate back over here to the dashboard, and it looks like in this case that we've resolved that the increased load that's being applied to our app. And so what you've seen here is that we're really taking platform as a service to the next level. What we're doing with some of these tools is allowing you to, within Visual Studio, start modeling that relationship between your code and the cloud services you're going to consume. We're also going to start introducing this composite app service, which acts as that controller, takes in that model, provisions and configures, and even monitors those services on our behalf. And then finally, what you saw is how we're going to bring workflow to the cloud by providing a scale-out multi-tenant host for running Windows Workflow Foundations within the Windows Azure platform.
It's a new way to build apps.
Exactly.
For the cloud.
Great.
Thanks, James. So what we've seen today is a very broad set of new capabilities that are available in Windows Azure to help you write these next generation of applications. Now, we've talked about a lot of things and covered a lot of ground. And what we wanted to do was make it easy for you to get a list of all of these new services and get clarity on what dates they will be available, when they'll be in CTP, and so you can first start working with it, when we'll begin charging, when they go into beta, and when ultimately they'll be available for GA. So for the next milestone for all of these things, we've put this up on the web under microsoft.com/news, so you can take a look at that and get all those details. So that really brings me back to the beginning. It brings me back to where I started. The PDC, the cloud, platform as a service, and of course, your applications. With Windows Azure, what we're doing is enabling you to take your existing applications to places that they've never been able to go to before. And we're allowing you to write a whole set of new applications that in the past you never could have dreamed were possible. Windows Azure is ready. Today, what we're about at the PDC is giving you a lot of information to make you ready. It all begins now. Thank you very much. Have a great PDC.